Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we take a journey into the dystopian abyss of Blade Runner 2049. Contrary to popular opinion, we actually aren't that crazy about Denis Villeneuve's sci-fi sequel, with Chris disappointed in the story, and me, Travis, frustrated about the visuals. We dig into the movie's deeper story, and ultimately, what's holding it back.
Blade Runner 2049.
That would have been a great way to introduce this movie. Like, you know, you get a shot of the landscape, then the burn of the title, then Blade Runner 2049, motherfucker.
You just throw it all the way back to it being an 80s action flick.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the film noir approach that the first Blade Runner used, but it's like, you know, a modernized version of that.
Yeah. Escape from New York.
Escape from L.A.
Escape from L.A. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I actually have never seen... this blows my mind saying it out loud, but I've never seen Escape from L.A.
Oh.
I'm a big fan of the first movie, but for some reason I've never caught the sequel.
That's surprising to me. Like, how many times have you seen Tammy and the T-Rex?
On the surface, that makes no sense to like use those two movies as a comparison, but knowing myself, that is a fair question. I've only seen it twice.
Okay. Then that's fine.
Although I saw it for the first time less than a year ago.
Tammy?
Yeah, Tammy and the T-Rex. It's not even a movie I really knew. I mean, I knew it existed. That's a lie. But I didn't know how much I needed to see it until... Vinegar Syndrome put out a 4K copy of it, and I was like, oh wait. And then I caught like one clip of the movie, and I was like, oh yeah, I need to see this.
Wait, so there's a 4K copy of Tammy and the T-Rex, but there's not a 4K copy of There Will Be Blood?
Actually, interestingly, I think there is going to be a foreign issue of There Will Be Blood in 4K UHD, but you're right, like the studio, like, why are we not getting an official like American version of this movie? It's crazy.
That's insane. I've recently gotten onto the 4K kick. I had a 2013 Panasonic for years and recently upgraded to a 4K TV. And it is such an amazing experience. This is, I think, just the second 4K movie I've watched on this TV.
The Blade Runner 2049?
Yeah, Blade Runner 2049.
Nice, yeah. And I mean, this is the kind of movie you want to watch in 4K.
It looks pretty exquisite.
Yeah.
Better than theater?
I just went to the theater for The Creator, and like that did take me back and made me remember, like, oh man, like these are the kinds of movies I really coveted finding at the theater. But at the same time, like, to have what the 4K experience gives you, especially if you have like a good setup and you can be close to your TV, like, it really is incredible what we can achieve sitting on our couches, you know, like to have this access to something this that looks this good in your home is crazy.
It is crazy. Did you enjoy The Creator?
I very much did enjoy The Creator. I'm a big Gareth Edwards fan.
That's a conversation for another episode then.
Yeah, I was going to talk about The Creator while we talked about this movie, so maybe we'll get into it.
I guess there is appropriate overlap. The main question, if people haven't listened to our Blade Runner episode, we covered Blade Runner already, and it was Travis's second time revisiting the movie?
Yes, first time, but second time visiting the movie.
Yeah, second time visiting the movie. But... you had watched the theatrical cut.
I think I watched the theatrical cut both times.
Yeah, you hinted that you might, or you said that you might watch the final cut. Did you have that opportunity?
I did have that opportunity.
You had that opportunity.
And I thought that would be a pulsating aspect of our conversation today.
Yeah, okay, wait, let's get into it then. Oh, wait, no. Oh,
we can just have a little like mini episode moment right now where I go over it. And maybe that actually would lead into Blade Runner 2049, or we can work it into the Blade Runner 2049 conversation. I actually think it would lead into it pretty good.
Yeah, I'm curious. Usually we do, when did you first hear about the movie?
Yeah,
and
yeah, blah, 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 all that boring stuff.
But I want to know, how. What did you think of the final cut versus, as someone who had only seen the theatrical, how did the final cut compare?
Okay, so I did a little cheating before I watched it, and I read everything that was different about it, which I think was a good thing to do because I realized that not much actually changed about it. So I enjoyed watching it again. Like, as I stated last time, I'm now a Blade Runner fan. Like, I didn't have a negative view of the movie, but I didn't latch onto it like other people had, people like Crystal Lambert. And I was excited to watch it again, and this time I really did, like, I connected with it, I saw what it was doing, I thought it, like, it transcended. Like, to me, I watch a lot of movies that, like, I like, that are just, like, doing the basic things I need movies to do, but then there are movies that take it to that next step, and I think Blade Runner does that. I still don't think I love it as much as everyone else, but I definitely connected with it in a way that was satisfying. So the final cut, I mean, I did, you know, I learned there are a few changes that caught my eye that I was excited about. Like, the color grading was changed. Like, it looks better. Like, it looks a little more, it's just a clear image of the world, even though the kind of hazier 1982 look fit into the, like, hardcore sci-fi film noir-y nature of the movie. But I did enjoy, like, seeing the movie in a new light. But other than that, it doesn't seem like much has changed. I guess some of the scenes are a little more violent, which I did notice and I do appreciate. But I wouldn't say that changed the experience too much for me. And the only real addition, as far as I can tell, is the unicorn thing. Which I don't... I guess this is where we get into it. Because let's explain this for everyone who doesn't know. Like, what is the addition of the unicorn scene, Chris?
What is the addition of it? Or
yeah, what, like, is... what is it? If people haven't seen the original Blade Runner, or have seen it and don't know about this unicorn scene, like I didn't, like, what is it?
Okay, so there was a scene in the initial cut of the movie that Ridley Scott showed to studio executives that had Deckard at one point, I think it's after his fight with Leon. He's a little drunk, a little out of it, and sitting at his piano, and he's hitting some keys, and he sees or has a daydream of a unicorn running through the woods. And that's all it is, 30 seconds, if that. And it's never brought up again until the very end of the movie when Gaff leaves a little origami unicorn.
Yeah.
And executives felt that it was too strange and had Ridley Scott take it out. So it wasn't in the initial theatrical version. But once he got to do his director's cut, it was one of the first things he threw back into the movie and has become a pretty big touchstone or imagery for the movie. You'll see a lot of unicorn symbolism for this movie. Especially even when they did the 30th anniversary Blu-ray, I think the unicorn was the main image used in the packaging.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I do have a shot in my eye of that now. And don't you have like a poster that has the unicorn on it?
Yeah, it's okay. From the 30th anniversary Blu-ray. It's the origami unicorn, tinfoil origami unicorn rearing up with this rain spattering it. And I got it done. I forget the Timothy Carmody, I think might be the the artist's name. He was in Canton, Ohio, and he would take window frames that still had the windows in them and do art on the glass. So it looks like you're hanging a window frame or a window and it has the art on it. And it was all over the Akron Canton Airport. And I ended up contacting him and getting this painting for $50 or something. And I think he's in LA now and selling paintings for a lot more.
Maybe you made him realize he can make it a career.
I think he was already well on his way. But
yeah, but like, you know,
my patronage.
He exclusively does movie posters now, though.
Right. Tim, you're pretty good at this. You should
just Blade Runner movie posters.
Just make it happen. Yeah, that would be quite thrilling.
That'd be a weird turn.
So the unicorn, did it work for you? Not as impressive.
So here's the headline that I think the inclusion of the unicorn sequence, like, I don't think, I guess I wouldn't argue that it either helps or hurts the movie. I definitely like the inclusion of it and everything we talked about on the Blade Runner episode. Go listen to it, guys. It was great. It does introduce a lot of psychological, philosophical, it kind of adds to the meat of the movie's commentary in a way. Like, technically it does. Like, it introduces a different conversation to be had at the very end of the movie, and it kind of makes you rethink everything in the movie, which I like when movies do that. It's cool. It makes a movie like linger with you longer afterwards. At the same time, especially, and I had this thought as I was watching Blade Runner 2049, I felt like the question of whether or not Deckard was a replicant became a bit of an overwhelming one and became this, like, it now feels like it's the entire reason. I don't know how to state this, but other than, like, I feel like that question has now become ever present and is an important part of, like, understanding the movie, where you didn't necessarily need it for Blade Runner to work. Like, I watched Blade Runner theatrical cut. The unicorn thing at the end made sense to me in terms of Rachel and what she represented and, like, this new life Deckard was going off to live. Like, there was a lot wrapped up in there that didn't need all that extra stuff to work. And now with all that extra stuff in there, I can't help but think that, like, A, that's all people care about now. It's answering this question of whether or not Deckard is a replicant, when I think the question of whether Deckard is or is not a replicant is just first and foremost, A, like, it's important for that question to exist and not have an answer. I think that's the power of the movie, is that at the end, he is just presented with this unicorn that makes him have this question about himself. Like, how does this guy know about the unicorn? And it's not a question of whether or not, like, am I or am I not a replicant? The question is, like, am I really so different from replicants? It's this moment that centers him and makes him realize, like, the point of existence and humanity and all that, and the kind of life he should be living. I feel like people just got obsessed with whether or not he is or is not a replicant, and that then bled into Blade Runner 2049, where that is kind of the whole movie's thrust. Is K human, or is he this hybrid? Like, what is he? What is his real existence? And, like, I feel like that has just become what these movies are about in a way. That this is just from my distance perspective. I'm not, like, wrapped up in the Blade Runner fandom, but, like, just doing some Googling, like, being on the Reddit page, like, knowing the kind of questions people want answered, like, it seems a lot of what people care about, and it just represents something I don't care about.
I think that's fair. I was just in this conversation the other day in a Reddit post, and people were going back and forth about, well, you know, this and that, and other people were coming in and saying exactly what you said. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If we have a definitive answer one way or the other, the point is we're not supposed to be able to tell.
Right.
That's the whole thing. That even at the end, Deckard goes from somebody who was judging replicants as other to someone who doesn't care and doesn't see a difference, whether that's in himself or in others. It just doesn't matter. And that should be the point that the viewer has as well, is that it doesn't really matter. It's just funny that Ridley Scott worked so hard to make sure that it did.
Yeah. And, like, that aspect of it, like, makes me kind of not like it. Like, the fact that the artist behind the picture who has full control over this existential question that's going to plague the movie, like, feels the need to give it an answer. Like, it kind of makes me question how much I trust Ridley Scott, I guess.
I think that's fair. I mean, it always goes to the death of the author conversation and how much we should care what they're intending versus what's there. Some of the other little fixes, I believe that when the dove flies away from Roy,
yeah,
it's daylight in the theatrical cut rather than raining.
Is it really? Is it not just like the lights pouring down on them?
No, it was different weather entirely.
Did the sun just come up at the end, like a sunrise, kind of like new day, symbolic sort of thing?
No, because Gaff then shows up and it's still raining.
It's full on noon.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, so just little things like that. There was a few improvements throughout. And then, yeah, the scene where Zora crashes through the glass.
Okay, yeah, that was what I noticed. So I guess that's my overall grading is, like, I think it's probably, like, technically a better movie because all those little things, I think those are improvements. But overall, my connection to the movie, I wouldn't say has changed very much.
Okay. Did you like not having the voiceover, or do you prefer the voiceover?
Honestly, I could go either way. As I said in the last episode, it reminds me of film noir, so, like, I kind of liked it for that. But at the same time, like, the movie definitely doesn't need that. I think it does help give the movie a little bit of ambiance. Like, I just think the whole opening of Blade Runner is so incredible, and we'll get into that as we talk about the opening of Blade Runner 2049. I just, like, love the way it, like, sets the mood of the world and you're pulled into it. And I think the narration does help with that, but watching it on its own, it doesn't necessarily need that for that to work.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
That was the big thing, I think, was the lesson, because I first saw Blade Runner in film class, and I think he legitimately had us watch it with the voiceover than without the voiceover. he was Robert Spadoni. He was very, he didn't care what you thought.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a classical character teacher.
That's how I would be.
Yeah, where you're like, oh, this guy seems like he thinks he's in a movie, or has a little bit of that classical professor from a movie dynamic. So he's just, we're going to watch this and I'm going to make you watch it again.
Yeah.
Just to see the difference of voiceover and not voiceover. But 2049, this was your second time watching it?
It is number two. Yep.
I think it was my I can't remember if I saw it twice in theaters or if I just saw it the one time and this is the second watch.
Man, I'm trying to remember if I saw it. I must have not seen it in theaters if I can't remember. I usually see any movie I see in theaters.
I was there opening night, very excited. Very, very excited. And I'm still going back and forth on how I feel about it.
Okay, I watched it in March of 2018, so I saw it at home.
Okay. I like it. I always,
the whole movie.
I like the whole movie.
Okay.
But I don't love the movie.
There's yeah, you want to love the movie.
Yeah, there's something that's just a little empty about it to me.
Yeah, and a little.
That gets a bit frustrating. And I don't like the direction that they took the Blade Runner story.
Okay, yeah, let's get into that, because I feel like this is your territory right here.
I mean, I don't know what I expected from a sequel to Blade Runner, really, in terms of where the plot was going to go, what the state of replicants would be. It's not like I had an idea in mind of what this needed to be. And even as I'm critical of it, I don't have some movies I know immediately it should have done this. This would have been a lot cooler. We should have gone there. With Blade Runner 2049, I don't have a concrete, this is a superior idea.
Right.
But the thing that I dislike the most in sequels, and that I think is the lowest hanging fruit and too many sequels go for, is being essentially a soft remake where they repeat characters, they have a lot of references that feel not necessary to the story, but forced into the story just because they know viewers will like it. And that gets really boring to me, and I think is maybe too simplistic.
I agree with all that.
It's just full of it. Blade Runner 2049 is just full of it.
Although I did enjoy seeing Edward James Olmos. I think that's something. I mean, I feel like we should have put a disclaimer at the top of this episode, because everyone loves this movie. And
I know.
And it sounds like, Chris, at least you like it. This is the second time I've seen it, and I haven't liked it either time. I think I felt the exact same way as I did last time as I watched it, where I'm just like, yeah, it's not like a terrible movie, but Jesus, like, it's just so long. I think this is something I've come to know about Denis Villeneuve. Now that I know how to say his name correctly. that I think he seems like a very intelligent person. And he has a good eye. Like, he can create a pretty shot. Like, this movie is a testament to that. And he is somebody who, like, I can see the machinations of his movie and what's trying to be said, but I can't help but think that, I don't know his process, and I haven't really investigated it. I don't know if it's something I can investigate, but, like, I don't know what his process is with the screenplay and kind of workshopping the screenplay and getting it to fit his vision. But I feel like that is just a problem that continually plagues him, is that the way he's shooting his movies, especially like post Sicario, like Prisoners and On, like I feel like his movies have had a similar feel, mood, and aesthetic. And I just don't think he's ever had strong enough characters to fulfill the space he's creating. I just get that sense that, like, it's not Denis' fault. Like, it's that the script really sucks and that, like, the things aren't being real. And that was just my feeling this whole movie. It was like, there's not enough work being done for me to feel this here or that here, like what they're trying to get me to feel, you know?
Yeah, it's covering a lot of territory, and the visuals throughout, especially there's the scene where Love's dropping the bombs and you just see the visual in her glasses as she's getting her nails done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the close up of the glasses and you see the scene that she's seeing, but also her eye. It's such a cool shot. And the fight in the water near the end is also, I think, the most interesting part of the movie visually. There's a ton throughout that I'm just, especially with the 4K, just sitting there going, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. The fight between Kay and Deckard in the Las Vegas club was also, like, always kind of stands out to me. But it does feel, so with Prisoners, Enemy, Sicario, even Arrival, but I feel like with Prisoners, Enemy, Sicario, there's, what's the word for it? There's a fullness still, or an intimacy to the shot still, without all the huge space.
I agree. Yeah,
that we get.
I would throw Arrival in there.
Arrival's the middle ground to me. I feel like Arrival has moments that start to introduce that sense of space and minimalism, two shots. And it's not minimalism, like the shot composition is empty. It's just minimalism in the sense that you have a lot of breathing room in the visuals.
Right.
And Arrival to me is the midpoint where you still have a lot of the intimacy in many of the shots, but you have these moments that feel very spaced out, especially when they're in the I forget what the aliens are called now, even though I just spent 30 hours writing about the movie.
I don't remember.
When you're in their ship, I feel like that really was the introduction to him having, and even the shots of the ship with the mist rolling over the hills, you start to get that sense of space. And that Blade Runner 2049 is where he really leaned into that emptiness and hollowness and a little bit of the void in the mise-en-scene. And that Dune is then just nothing but that.
Right.
So, yeah, I get the... There has been this developing aesthetic that is interesting, but I don't know if the story has served it as well.
Yeah.
Served in the way that it deserves.
I agree. You mentioning these... I feel like you brought this up last time of like... that I don't like movies that have a lot of space or a lot of like empty space. And my immediate reaction to that is still like, I don't think that's true. Like, I think there are plenty of movies I like that have tons of empty space. Like we talked about Lawrence of Arabia. I think it's more just that, like, I just wonder if the whole sci-fi, epic sci-fi thing just doesn't work for Villeneuve, like for his eye, for what he's trying to capture, for what's trying to be conveyed. Because like you said, by every account, Blade Runner 2049 should be an incredible movie. Like, you got Ryan Gosling in the center, you have Harrison Ford returning as Deckard, it's a continuation of this classic story, and you have Roger Deakins doing the cinematography. Yeah. You have Hans Zimmer doing the score. Like, I people post images from Blade Runner 2049 all the time on Twitter, and I look at the images and objectively, of course, like, wow, that looks incredible. Like, the use of space here, this really interesting way to frame, like, this close-up. And then you throw on top of that, like, it looking so good in 4K, you throw in the Hans Zimmer's score. Like, all of these things should be making it work, and maybe people do. I mean, obviously, people are connecting with it. People love this movie. But I can't help but get the sense that it's sacrificing something more important, more intimate. Like, I guess that's more of what I'm getting at, is like his movies have started to feel less intimate to me. Like, even something like Prisoners, which, as we talked about in the show, like, is a movie I don't really like for a lot of other reasons. Like, I did think of Prisoners several times during this movie, and like, well, Prisoners did a way better job of like this. You know, like, yeah. I felt way more connected to the characters of Prisoners when these kinds of ideas or these fears are being explored. But I mean, you mentioned those movies much earlier. I would go even earlier, like thinking about Polytechnique is still my favorite Denis Villeneuve movie. I remember enjoying Incendies, although I don't remember it super well. I remember Polytechnique very well, though. And that movie is very intimate. I mean, and it has nothing to do with the setting. Like, obviously, like, they're in a school in that movie. Like, it's a little different. But I don't think that same kind of intimacy, that same sort of, it isn't even necessarily the intimacy, but just how close you feel to the characters and what they're going through. I just am starting to wonder if the sci-fi realm doesn't lend Villeneuve that power, or he doesn't know how to navigate it yet, or he hasn't had the right screenplay for it yet, or... God forbid, majestic cinematography from Roger Deakins and a soaring score from Hans Zimmer, like, doesn't fit this, like, what Villeneuve's strengths are. Like, maybe someone else can turn Blade Runner 2049 into this incredible movie where, like, the visuals and the score are, like, all kind of drawing out what I know about these characters and, like, the path they're on. But for whatever reason, I feel like all of the elements aren't mixing and they aren't hitting me in the way they seem to hit everyone else.
It's just what's the struggle for me is the fact that you have very empty characters.
Right.
It's not as if Blade Runner spent a lot of time developing Rachel or developing Tyrell. Mm-hmm. It's not that we spent a lot of moments with Leon. Even Roy, for the most part, is pretty one notes for a lot of the movie until you get to the end and it kind of opens up. But there's such a difference in, I think, the degree of humanity or believability in the world that jumps out to me, where I never really believe Robin Wright in this movie. I never really believe Batista, I think, does a good job, but I don't believe, what's his face? Jared Leto. Jared Leto's character is so hollow and empty and pointless.
And it's kind of a centerpiece of the movie's like ideological foundation, like the whole new angle it's introducing to this universe.
Yeah. Oh, that's the thing that's so annoying too, is it's the same issue with The Force Awakens, right? You have this sequel to Star Wars and you go, wow, they can do anything. It's a whole galaxy and universe. What are they going to do? They could go anywhere. They don't have any ties to bind them. They just have the established,
other than nostalgia.
Yeah, nostalgia, and you have, you know, light side, dark side, force, whatever, but you have decades of video games, novels, comics, fan fiction. Like, you could go so many places with this. And what do they do? The First Order, which is just the remnants of the Empire. And look, they're doing everything the Empire was doing, and they're somehow just as present as the Empire was, and not lacking in any way. It feels like the Empire was never defeated. So you just have the Empire back. And that's such a cop-out and such a cheap, unoriginal, stupid thing to do.
Yeah.
And I feel bad then segueing that to Blade Runner 2049, because it's the same screen. Like, Hampton Francher or Fancher worked on Blade Runner. Like, he wrote the Blade Runner script. He's the one that said we should name the movie Blade Runner. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
I just don't know why this was the call that they made, was to say, oh yeah, we have just Tyrell 2.0. It's Tyrell. He's picked up everything that Tyrell does. It's the same stuff, but it's a little different. It's one of the worst ways to go about a sequel. And my least favorite thing that's a lot of sequels end up doing. And Wallace, I think, is the worst example of a character doing that I've ever seen. It just, the difference, if you watch a scene with Tyrell, and the believability, the humanity, even just the shots of him, he's not a character in quotes. He's a person in this world that is a little strange. Jared Leto in this, like, Nander Wallace is...
he's hamming it up.
Yeah, it's a comic book villain that's giving these big, stupid speeches that's making almost no sense. The first scene with him seeing the birth of the replicants and then cutting it open, nonsense. I mean, it's not... you can... obviously, he's saying things relevant to the movie and some of the themes, but why would anybody say any of those things and do any of those things in that moment? It stretches believability and just doesn't fit, I think, the tone of the previous world at all.
I agree.
When you have the showdown with Deckard, what the hell is that? It's just an ultimately pointless scene, and then he just disappears to go off-world. There's no conclusion. It almost seems more of a setup for a third movie that I don't know if we're ever going to get.
That's all I could think when they introduced the whole Underground Revolution thing, and like, oh, that just goes away. And I'm like, wait, what is this movie like going for and setting up? I found it very confusing.
There's the idea of giving context to frame subtext, with the idea of we're seeing the pieces put into place for a replicant revolution. We now know that they can give birth. This is going to start a revolution. We know that Wallace is reeling in some ways. He lost his favorite angel, Love. So are we going to see the overthrow of Wallace, the rise of the replicants, and this new world order established?
All stuff I don't care about.
Yeah, I mean...
I care about the people in the movie and what's happening to them.
Yeah, and the people in the movie, just setting it up to where you have Kay. I also don't like the cop-out of saying the most human thing you can do is die for a cause. It's a bow to wrap up his character arc.
Yep.
Of, we faked you out that he's not this special child. He's just your everyday replicant. But we're going to give him this opportunity by explicitly stating to you that it's human to die or to sacrifice yourself for a cause. And that feels cheap to me. It's almost like the equivalent in a sci-fi movie of just having the hive mind be the enemy, or a horror movie where you have the situation that seems absolutely untenable, or these monsters that are vicious and how can you ever defeat them? It's like, oh, you just have to kill the one. That's it. Is it that like nice and sweet that you just have to find the one and do that, and that takes out all the rest? It's overly relied upon as just a way to wrap things up. And I feel like this was the equivalent of that. It's almost like a... It's not writing 101. It's more of a writing 202 kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's still not good.
I mean, you mentioned the all the replicant characters in the original Blade Runner earlier. I mean, I guess I can extend it to just all characters in this movie. Like you mentioned Robin Wright. I do get a, like, they don't feel like real people to me, like everyone in Blade Runner felt. Like, thinking about just all the replicants alone in Blade Runner and how they're just wild and naturally interesting and full of personality and ideas. Like, they're very exciting antagonists because they make you question their antagonism. Like, do they have a reason to be this way? Like, they kind of pull you in and have presence in a way and have full-bodied characters that have arcs that you understand, that you care about. I just don't see how anyone could feasibly argue that about any of the people in this movie, besides Kay, maybe, who, I mean, his arc is the whole movie, so that's, it's inherently there. But people like Robin Wright are just there to deliver lines, like something, like her and Kay's whole conversation at the beginning about like having a soul, you know? And he's like, you've done fine so far without one. Like, their entire conversation is just like, just lines like that, where it's the screenwriter being like, eh, right? Like, this is what the movie's about. Like, instead of, that's not how I picture Blade Runner. Like, there are little moments here and there of philosophical ponderings, but they aren't ham-fisted into the dialogue like that. And they aren't ever present. Like, they aren't camping constantly like they do in this movie. Like, so many conversations between Kay and what's Ana de Armas's character?
Joy.
Like, all of their conversations end up being about that. Like, yeah. it seems, and then you noted the whole Underground Revolution and like the question they ask him, like, they aren't even there to like have a real purpose other than like once again pushing this question that plagues Kay. And again, that's kind of what I meant as I was reflecting on the unicorn scene in Blade Runner and thinking of, like, did it do more harm than good? Like, are we suddenly just obsessed with this one question of, like, are you or are you not human, when that doesn't really matter? And this whole movie is just, to me, plagued by that question. Like, I think there is inherently drama there. And I think on the surface, like, it is an interesting way to take Kay's character, especially thinking about Blade Runner and thinking about how... Batty. Is it Batty? I keep forgetting his name.
Yeah, Roy Batty.
Like, to me, that guy is like kind of the main character of the movie in a way.
Yeah.
His story ends up being the one you care about and you're invested in at the end. So it seems cool to me to have Kay be the central character and to inherently have that, all that drama there. But it's just the way they went about it, and it just felt very dry, a very dry and languid way to take on that story, especially thinking about Batty and how like full of life his character is and how interesting and exciting his journey is. Like, I feel like they purposely make Kay's journey slow, methodical, languid. Like, it's done on purpose, like in a sort of art house dramatic kind of way that I think Villeneuve started with. But it just, it's never hitting me in this movie.
No. And even the whole, it's not even, Joy's not even, is she AI? I guess she's AI.
I guess, yeah.
The whole arc there of essentially arguing whether or not she has a personality or not, and is just programming or transcends programming, and the dynamic that she and Kay have, it's interesting, but also I don't think it goes far enough, or almost does it feel necessary to the rest of the story in any way. If you were to take out that plot point, remove Joy entirely, I don't think the movie changes a single bit.
I mean, I guess ostensibly that whole relationship is there because you realize that Kay has never, doesn't have any real human relationships. And now he's like, has this question of like, am I human? And like, why can't I be human and have human relationships? Like, all I have is this woman named Joy. I guess that's her, the only reason she's there.
Somewhat. I mean, it's essentially trying to ask the same question that Blade Runner did, right, of are the replicants people? And we get, is Joy a person? Which then Villeneuve stomps on with the advertisement at the end.
Yeah.
And having her just be this sexual thing and calling him a Joe, and he realizes that's where he got his name, and it undermines essentially everything that they shared in some ways.
So I guess that's kind of the point of it, like for him to realize that these connections he has with AI, like, I guess as I'm saying it out loud, it doesn't really make sense. Like, I guess it just makes him feel more lonely.
It makes him feel lonely. There is something to, maybe it does make him want to lean in more to the human element, which is why he's so ready and willing to sacrifice himself at the end, because he realized how artificial that had been. But it's also strange. I also don't necessarily like that they made Love's motivation almost like the spurned woman who's just trying to get revenge for petty reasons.
Yeah, right.
That was strange. I like the idea that she tries to connect with him when they're looking at Rachel's bones or doing that initial Rachel serial number conversation. They listen to the audio between Deckard and Rachel from back in the day, and Kay says he likes her, or she likes him. That's why, yeah, she's kind of trying to get a reaction. And Love says, somebody asking personal questions about you can really show interest and make you feel good. And then asks Kay very pointedly, do you like your job, or whatever she asks him. But the subtext is clear that she wants to connect with him. And it's kind of a romantic thing. And he shuts her down because he's committed to Joy.
Mm-hmm.
But then everything after that kind of colors what Love's doing as a little revenge driven, a little, yeah, petty.
I had trouble following her motivation, honestly.
Yeah, so she's loyal to Wallace, but it also seems like she wants to overthrow Wallace.
Right, yeah. Or just has feelings for Thanes and for other replicants that she is forced to push down. So, like, that's why she cries, is that, like, I have to stay loyal. Like, I'm going to keep doing your bidding, but I'm also sad for these people.
Yeah. And then, but in the conversation with Robin Wright, it seems, yeah, that she's, right, she admits that she's been lying, and that she essentially says Robin Wright's trying to kill this thing that's going to be a miracle. I guess that's in line with what Wallace is saying. Wallace wants the child so he can figure out how to continue reproduction. So it's almost like Wallace and the revolutionaries have a similar, they both want the kid known, but for different reasons. But I still get the sense that Love could have been on the side of the revolution if she just had a conversation with them, or maybe wasn't entirely loyal to Wallace. I don't know.
Man.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Mine's racing as you're talking. I'm just thinking of like so many things, so many reasons I think this movie went in the wrong direction. Like, you're introducing all these different elements of the world that kind of expand it, and these really big players and these people with deeper intentions and these conflicting powers battling each other. I think this movie really stressed the scope and the bigness of the world. Like, it wanted to create a rich world where there are all these competing entities, and these competing entities are very invested in this child, whoever this child is, like what replicants are capable of and what that means for the future. I think that's all done in an effort to make the movie feel big, when I guess I just think that's the wrong direction and something I'm really not that interested in. I'm only interested in it if it's challenging the psychology of the movie and the psychology of the characters and what they're going through. Like, to me, Blade Runner, everything that happens in that movie does feel huge to me, like does have profound implications for the world just because of this single character journey we're watching and what he's going through and what he's realizing. Like, to me, that completely spells out psychology of this world and the way people are and the kind of tension they face in their everyday lives of like what it means to be human and be a part of this world. I guess I just don't get that sense from 2049. It's more done in an effort to like, it feels studio-y to me in that way of like, build the world, like have all these new elements. Like, we can bring Jared Leto back later. Like, if he's there and he plays this kooky character, like too much of that seems to be happening to me in the movie that I'm not as invested suddenly in this woman at the end who's in this building, creating memories for people. Like the build to her and all of the tension around her, like it isn't really just coming from Deckard and Kay. Like the movie's trying to make it bigger than that in a way that it feels unsuccessful to me. Like if that's really the route and they're not using those bigger entities to get at the core emotion of the movie and like you're moving you there at the very end, the way like Batty moves you at the end of Blade Runner, you know, I'm just not sensing that.
No, not even, not even a little bit.
No, which it's a very languid ending where he just kind of waltzes up and Ryan Gosling dies on the steps. Like, it's trying to feel like heavy and dramatic in a way that, I don't know, it has none of the theatrics of Blade Runner.
No, and I miss that a lot. It does feel just a lot more like a collection of story beats.
Right.
Than an actual necessary movie that we're getting.
Which baseline should every movie should check that box, like a movie we need that we're getting.
it has one of the things that annoys me the most in sequels, and I'm going to go back to Star Wars again.
All right.
These also came out around the same time, which is fascinating, but it's what the characters have been doing in the aftermath of the first movie. And there tends to be especially in sequels, they've done nothing. Which right. In some ways makes sense of most people live very bland lives. And usually what makes up a movie is the most exciting time in someone's life. So if there hasn't been that much going on,
sure,
of course it's going to be like a little basic. But you look at, essentially, Deckard has been, he had a year with Rachel, I think it was. They got pregnant almost immediately, and then he leaves. So that's it. Like, all of this buildup, all of this, all the stuff from the first movie just results in them having a year together, and then him hanging out in Las Vegas for 30 years.
Yeah.
That's it.
Kind of a nice life.
He's just done, it's just so uninteresting to me. And then it's the same thing with Luke, where you wonder, oh, you know, it's Return of the Jedi. What's it going to be? And then in Force Awakens, you're told, yeah, he started a school, did it go well, and now he's just been missing for 30 years.
Floating on some rock on an island.
Yeah, I think it's a very unimaginative thing to do with your legacy characters. And it happens more than I would like.
It's really stupid. Like, I completely agree with you and, like, have acknowledged all these things in my head probably as I've watched these movies. But, yeah, you saying it out loud, just like, what are we doing? Like, these are important people in cinema, these characters, to just kind of, like, lazily toss them into a movie, like, give them no agency or action in the last, like, there, it just seems like a, what is that move?
Yeah, it's boring. And then you mentioned, you know, Deckard's daughter. There was a conversation I was having on Reddit where people were wondering if Deckard's daughter was full replicant or half human, half replicant, and that getting back to, is Deckard a replicant or not?
Mm-hmm.
And I think either way, it's impressive. The person I was talking to was saying that just the kid being a full replicant isn't that interesting. I was like, well, yeah, they haven't been able to procreate.
Yeah.
And that's what we hear the revolutionaries say. If we can have kids, we suddenly become our own masters.
Right.
And we control our fate. Because right now, they need Wallace to make them. And that's the kind of the enslavement that they're facing. So being able to have replicant children is a big deal. And that also ties into the whole conversation of, to be born is to have a soul, that Kay says mm-hmm. earlier, and would be the difference between, like, Kay not being born, in quotes, and Anna, that's the girl's name, being born mm-hmm. and having a soul. And it does feel like there's a difference between Anna and Kay in just terms of how they're acting. But I don't know. If it was half human, half replicant, I don't know what that adds or subtracts.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
I want a slight correction here. He doesn't say to be born is to have a soul. He says to be born is to have a soul, dot, 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 I guess. Which, like, to me, perfectly, like, thinking about that line, which is, like, it's kind of a crucial line in a way. Not crucial in the sense that it needs to be said, which I don't think it needs to be said, but crucial in the sense, like, okay, like, this is spelling out the movie's intentions.
Yeah.
The throw in the I guess to me is just, like, captures just the languidness and meanderingness of this movie. Like, I think that's my biggest complaint, honestly. If a lot of parts had been cut out, maybe, like, as you mentioned, the part of Joy, just things that are harping on the idea of the movie but not exactly building on it, I think this could have been a lot more successful. But as it stands, like, I almost have, like, a moral vendetta against long movies at this point. Like, movies that are just become longer and longer. Like, this movie has no business being 2 hours and 44 minutes long. It just doesn't. Like, if you're just there to see pretty images, I guess, like, that's great. But I would say they're more pretty than, like, powerful images. If you want to have powerful images for 2 hours and 44 minutes, then I'm in. And if I feel like these images are guiding me towards like a better understanding of this character and this world, but I just don't think that's the case with this movie. It feels like it's constantly dragging us through pretty shots. And I just, like I said, a lot of people like this movie. They don't mind doing that for 2 hours and 44 minutes, but I found it to be a little torturous. Like there's no reason this movie to be longer than 2 hours, in my opinion. Like it can introduce all the same ideas and have all the same pretty shots at once. Like I just have a hard time grasping like why this movie flows and functions in the way it does and why people are just so forgiving of it. Like I feel like you wouldn't be forgiving of this maybe just because it's Blade Runner, just because it's Ryan Gosling, just because it's Denis Villeneuve. Like we say like, oh, this is a masterpiece. But I feel like if anyone else is involved, like this is not excusable.
I mean, I find it very drinkable in a way. I don't mind the runtime, even though I'm not necessarily pleased with the movie. I never find myself that unhappy while watching it the way that I am with some other movies.
In the way I was with this movie.
Yeah, the creator started to feel interminable to me at some points. Or even Oppenheimer started to feel very much.
Yeah, the last third of Oppenheimer for sure.
And people love the last third of Oppenheimer. Yeah, I know. I do think that there's something about, yes, the Blade Runner name, the aesthetic and visuals that this movie has, you don't really find anywhere else. Especially in a lot of the big blockbuster sci-fi, John Carter, you're not getting shots like this. What's another? Even Star Wars wasn't necessarily giving you shots like this.
I gotta say this. Everything. I mean to interrupt you, but you know, you're bringing up other movies. Like, do other movies look like this? Part of like my frustration with this is I feel like movies do look like this, or at least like have like an epic feel to them. Like the creator, like Gareth Edwards movies or like a Zack Snyder movie. But those are both directors that people don't like for what I believe to be more of like trivial reasons, or just based on like them being annoyed, like a story isn't handled a certain way or characters saying like dumb things, like all of these things that have nothing to do with like the core meaning of a movie and what it's saying visually. I feel like people have always hated on directors like that, and so they roll their eyes at something like the creator or anything Zack Snyder has done. In a way, they won't with the Blade Runner 2049 or Dune. You know, it seems strange to me that I guess I don't know what Villeneuve is bringing to this movie that a director like Snyder doesn't bring to an epic like sci-fi or superhero movie. Like there's such breadth and wonder to his shots in a way that feel way more powerful than anything in this movie.
To me, what stands out is the pacing of the shots, which we have talked about before, but I think Villeneuve sits a little more.
He sure does.
In the shot and tends to have a bit more.
But
distance.
To what effect?
I mean, it creates a bit more of that, I guess, what I called earlier, that sense of minimalism or that sense of gaze that I don't think that you necessarily, like, Snyder brings a lot more of a...
He's like art
pop. Kinetic energy to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same... Who is the other one that you named?
Gareth Edwards.
Oh, the creator. Yeah, like Gareth Edwards, he has shots. I mean, I love Rogue One a lot. I think Rogue One's actually a good example of a great middle ground of where Villeneuve could be if the movies weren't so slow and he wasn't just like sitting back so much. But the creator is one where I don't think Edwards was actually going for enough. It seemed like a step back to me in a lot of ways from Rogue One.
Yeah, right. I thought it was a step back in general, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't... When I ranked it, I put it in the almost
that category. That seems fair.
I feel like narratively, visually, it has all the ingredients It's just I wanted a little bit more from each thing.
Yeah, sure.
But Blade Runner 2049, I think that people can feel a magnetism to a little bit more of that methodical nature that Villeneuve brings to it. I guess so, yeah.
They must.
Which I think can feel a little more mechanical to you than
it feels methodical. Very mechanical to me.
Yeah. So it's like they're getting the same thing that you're getting from Snyder or Edwards, but they like the methodical nature of it. So I get what he's doing. I feel like he's not the problem in some of these movies. Honestly, I like Dune way more than I like 2049. though I have to rewatch Dune to see if I stand by that statement.
I feel like eventually we're going to do it in the show, so I will rewatch it, and I do not look forward to that day.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because you love the original Dune a lot, right?
I absolutely love David Lynch's Dune, which should tell you everything you need to know about me.
Yeah, I mean, and that gets at what we're saying about like kinetic versus methodical, like, yes. Intimate and human driven versus that kind of spacey minimalist or distance.
Yeah.
But I don't think this movie also did enough with the daughter to really matter as well, like especially to end with her. And
right, yeah, she's not thrown into the equation until like the last part of the movie.
Yeah, we get the small conversation with her, and then her importance comes up. I don't think she actually had an autoimmune disease.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah,
she's probably about to find that out at the end.
Yeah, I think that's the cover of we just said that so we could keep you in hiding.
Yes,
which is very similar to the creator.
very true.
Keeping Alfie in hiding until they feel like they can use her, but that gets interrupted. I think my ideal sequel to Blade Runner would have been something that just flashed forward a little bit more in the same universe. Mm-hmm. Take us off world, show us post-replicant integration. What's that like?
Yeah.
Or even like, what's it mean if there's the last human? What's that story?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I can sum up everything I feel about this movie just by talking about the openings of each one, where like I think the opening of Blade Runner, especially since both movies use an eye to start the movies,
mm-hmm.
Like the opening of Blade Runner, the eye has a mysteriousness to it. Like there's such power to it, especially with like the firework going off in it and that kind of previewing the world and like these weird, you know, rain drenched streets and like these advertisements floating around and it giving you a sense of what everyday life is like there. And at the same time, previewing the movie's like themes and the just general aesthetic of the movie, like what it's about and how the visuals inform what you're watching. Like all that to me, like is happening right away in Blade Runner that I see it and I'm like, oh, like somebody visually focused, somebody who's purely thinking about like establishing the aesthetic and helping you understand where you're at. Like that person made this movie, where Blade Runner 2049 again feels like a little too highbrow for me at the beginning. Like it's just a shot of an eye, which fades into shots of fields, which then just leads us into what feels like a police procedural at the very beginning, like a detective walking in and just questioning somebody. Like it all feels very, again, languidly performed and executed. And they're more concerned if they're being like mysteriousness and drama underpinning the whole thing than like making you part of this world and like kind of electrifying your senses in a way that Blade Runner does. Like I'm just more interested in a movie like that than what Villeneuve's giving me. So yeah, you're right. Like people probably do appreciate that methodical nature. And I think it actually, now that I'm saying it out loud, does reflect more of the nature of television and people maybe like seeing television in their movies. But I can't help but be immediately bored by it, especially compared to Blade Runner, which I just watched.
Yeah.
It's fresh on the mind.
It's really frustrating. Just the eye thing alone is a great contrast, because the style that's on display in Blade Runner,
yeah,
with that opening shot of the eye and the journey towards the Tyrell Corporation, and you get this sense of strangeness, boldness, scope, scale, but also the eye just returning over and over and being this beautiful but also haunting thing. It puts you in such a mental, emotional, and existential place right at the beginning, where the opening eye in 2049 is empty. It's completely forced,
right,
because the previous movie did it. That's all that it is. It's a gesture,
yeah,
rather than something that is part of a whole or necessary or earned. And I think that's how I feel about 2049, is that so many of the choices made throughout it are gestures that are right, made because they had to be made to placate a imagined audience or judgment or expectation for what a Blade Runner 2049 sequel should be, rather than an essential story.
Yeah, right. I agree with that. I mean, that's probably naturally going to be a part of any of these franchise movies, especially ones that get made like 30, 40 years later. Like, a lot of it's just, I mean, the very fact that they did release multiple versions of Blade Runner was purely studio greed. Like, what? Let's update it again and like make more money off it and have a new theatrical run, even though there aren't really that many differences. Like, Blade Runner feels a little plagued by that.
Ridley Scott, I think, really wanted those differences.
I know he did, for the first cut, but like to do a second cut seems very funny to me.
Yeah, I think that was also something that had just bothered him for a while. Like, he was in there filming new scenes.
Yeah,
that's how like into it he was,
which is cool. I just I don't think it changes what the movie's about enough for it to be warranted.
Yeah, it's but it's very, I also didn't like, I didn't really think about it the first time through, like the male female dynamic in this movie. I know the first Blade Runner, people go back and forth on the portrayal of women in the movie,
mm-hmm,
but this one just felt particularly cold and cruel. I know
I
we kind of got into it with Love, but even the final shot being of Deckard, I get that Deckard's your main character from the first movie. You're bringing him to this point of seeing his daughter, but all the emotional weight is put on the father looking on the daughter, and we don't get anything from the daughter realizing this is her father. It seems like such a masculine, limited view on the power of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's something where they wrote a bit more and they edited it out because they're like, audiences only care about Deckard. But I think it encapsulates the way in which this movie consistently misses the emotional thrust of everything.
Yeah.
That we don't get her hearing that this is her father. We don't get to see the emotional reaction to it. That we don't see her hand on the glass. We don't see both of them at the end. That it's just a shot of Deckard at the end.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say is that I couldn't help but think of a number of other movies while watching this movie, and just why I liked all these other movies more. Like, A, The Creator, we mentioned. Like, despite whatever flaws it has, which I'm open, like, I think there are some things about it that probably don't work for a lot of people that I completely understand. Like, to deny the look of that movie, especially since the budget was so low, and what they were able to achieve beyond just, like, looking at an image of a pretty thing, like, the weight it flows and feels in that movie, like, it just feels, it feels so calculated and realized and alive in a way that I'm constantly like, well, like, none of that's happening in this movie. You know, I had just watched The Creator, so like, it was fresh in my mind. And then I also, that scene where Kay is with Joy and Joy is like going in another woman's body and they're gonna have sex, like, to me,
yeah,
that's what her did. with the same kind of situation with AI, you know? And I, you know, it's kind of cool. Like, they do some cool stuff with it in 2049, like the holding of the hand and the women like flowing in and out of each other. But like, it went on for a while, and like, it, at some point it just felt like a play with visuals as opposed to it feeling like raw and dramatic. And Her does a fantastic job of that. It's you're so pulled into that scene and everything it says about those characters and their relationship in much less time. Again, my complaint about this movie, like, it just is more efficiently done and more powerfully done. So like, they're not even comparable. And then the last movie I think of is 2046, which is the Wong Kar-wai's futuristic movie, which I almost would say had more of a visual influence in this movie than Blade Runner did. Like, just because like it's a more modern movie, you know. They look and feel very similar, except that Wong Kar-wai like has a stylish sexiness to his movies, you know. Like, they're just so alive in a way that it just made me think of 2049 the whole time. And like, man, this movie, like, there's nothing going on around these characters ever.
Yeah, no, that's a painful scene.
Oh, the sex scene?
The sex scene, yeah. I just thinking about, like, especially I was thinking about her, too, and realized that I had some anticipation for how that scene was going to go because I was confusing it with her. And when it actually played out, I was like, oh, yeah, this is just, like, doing this visual thing because they can.
Yeah.
Rather than it necessarily being something a little more meaningful. And then we don't even really, what's it even matter to Kay at that point?
I guess it's like the blending of AI and human when he's having that own wrestle with himself.
Yeah.
But my issue would just be more that, like, I don't think the movie's done enough with that idea. It made me feel enough for it for this scene to hit. So now I'm just watching, like, you know, a scene that feels more like visual trickery than something emotional and powerful.
Yeah. The only other maybe minor thing to discuss, and then we can get out of here.
Yeah.
Do you think, how into the Prometheus Blade Runner connection are you?
The movie Prometheus?
Yeah.
I'm unaware of this.
Okay, so
I'm into it, though, because I like Prometheus.
In the movie Prometheus, Peter Weyland, right? That's the old rich dude.
I'm well aware of the Weyland Enterprise.
Yeah, he has an email in his like diary or a diary entry that mentions Eldon Tyrell.
Oh wow!
So that specifically places Prometheus occurring in the same universe as Blade Runner. Which, you know, Ridley Scott directs both movies. It seems like it might just be like an easy Easter egg.
And are they both Warner Brothers movies?
I don't know.
It's Warner Brothers, right?
It's Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Covenant was 20th Century Fox.
All right. I don't know what's going on there then.
But there's a shot in Blade Runner 2049 when they're at Wallace's studio, his factory, when they're walking by all the people encased in glass, all the kind of like replicant models. And I think we see the Series 8 at one point, there's a shot of. But one of the models in a tank looks like the engineers from Prometheus. So that had fans in a tizzy because they were thinking that, is this actually supposed to be a Prometheus engineer? Like, what does this mean?
I'm only interested in it if they can do what, and this is genuine, everyone hates Alien vs. Predator, but I thought Alien vs. Predator did a great job of blending the franchises because they have such antagonistic themes, like one being about just women and female empowerment and like their place in society, and then Predator being this machismo figure, you know, like kind of he's almost meant to just emasculate all the men in the original Predator.
Yeah,
like to have those two forces clashing, like I actually thought they did something interesting with it. So if they're able to do that, which it seems like there's a lot of inherent ways they could do that between the alien, you know, just between the idea of Prometheus and like meeting your maker and all that, and the idea of a replicant and all that, but they would have to do a good job with it. And I don't trust studios to do a good job with anything at this point.
No, neither do I. I feel like every movie at this point is just a disappointment until proven otherwise.
Yeah, sometimes it feels that way.
But I do wish, the more that we've talked about it, I do wish that they would have done something with Blade Runner that would have been off-world and just a consequence of the first movie, but not necessarily beholden to the first movie in the way this was.
Sure.
And I think that's what holds this movie back, is that it keeps trying to imitate without ever really taking the opportunity to do something new.
I would have to agree with you.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to rank this baby?
Oh, God. Okay.
Okay. Movie rankings. This is how it goes. We started ranking movies at some point last year. I started in January of 2022. I started ranking every movie I've watched. Chris started in July of 2022. So this is not our all-time movie rankings. Everyone gets such a tizzy about this. No. Yes, we've seen more movies than this. These are just rankings of every movies we've watched since starting them. My list is up to 458 movies.
Ooh, I'm at 161.
All right. You're getting there. You're going to catch me one of these days. yeah. As a slight update, I did change my Blade Runner ranking because I do think that the Final Cut is a technical improvement. And especially after our conversation we had about the movie, I really started to enjoy it more. So now I have it at, where the hell did I put it? So I think before I had it at 240-ish, and now I have it at 195.
Okay, that's a leap.
It's a leap. It's jumping over a lot of movies I really like. Like The Boy Next Door.
Looking forward to 5 years from now, just having a conversation, and you're like, Chris, I went back and I have Blade Runner on 4K now. I've rewatched. Oh, wait, you have it? No, you rented it.
I
have it on
it.
4K now. I've watched it more times. I adore it now. It's in the top 25.
If it ever got to my top 25, it would make me hate 2049 even more.
Imagine how I feel.
I think that's a big part of it for me, is that like, if I was way more attached to Blade Runner, I'd probably really, really hate this movie. But I'm with you, even though it sounds like I just complained the whole time. I don't necessarily like this movie. It's not for me. But I agree with you in the sense that it's drinkable. Like, it's never offensive. Maybe offensive in its runtime. But beyond that, it's never offensive to me. Like, I like all the people in it. And I like watching Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford and Ana de Armas. Like, they're all great. I just don't think what's around them is so great always.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay. So where's 2049 rank for you?
Blade Runner, 2049. It's not down in the like unforgivable portion of my rankings, which would be like 430 and below. So actually not that many movies really that are down in that region, but it is down in the not for me section. And I'm placing it right now as I'm looking at it. I think I'm going to go, I mean, it's better than that movie. Oh my God. Yeah. Wow. You know where I'm going to put it? Literally right underneath Prisoners. I mean, that made it easy because like I definitely like Prisoner. I actually it's making me think I should rethink my Prisoners ranking. Like, while I don't necessarily like that movie, like I can't deny that like some parts of it are powerful in ways that 2049 wasn't. So I'd have to think on that, but for now it's just one below Blade Runner at 413.
Okay. Yeah, bump that Prisoners up.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
I have 2049. I still like I'm still like a bit of a Villeneuve simp.
Sure.
So because as much as I can nitpick the story to death, the whole drinkable thing, the watchable thing to me, like
it's important.
If I was gonna go put the movie back on right now, I could sit through it and be content. Having just watched it, I wouldn't complain too much. So I have complaints, but I don't hate the movie. I'm just frustrated by what it is versus what I feel like it could have been or should have been. But still, relative to a lot of other movies that I watch, it still makes me happier. It's more in line with what I want to see. So I have it in the impressive category, which is tier 3 for me.
Wow.
It's at number 40, just above The Lighthouse and below Scream 6.
All right. I do find that surprising. Like, I don't disagree that it's watchable, and I just put watchable in quotes. But man, maybe I'm just getting to a point where I need something to be more than watchable, because I feel like that did used to be my ceiling in a way. Like, I used to like just crave, like, oh God, please just don't let it be fucking torture. But I maybe I've just watched a lot of good movies lately, but like that invigorate me as I'm watching them. Like, I need my movies to do a little bit more.
It's still the visuals for me in this that are like up my alley, to where that kind of wins the day for me.
All right.
Over some of the character stuff. But like, especially I'm looking at some of the movies below it. Like, the movies in the just below it, Lighthouse is at the very bottom of the impressive category. So it's Blade Runner's like near the bottom. And then at the top of really good is Midsommar, Bones and All, Babylon, Elvis, Black Phone, Cosmopolis, Top Gun Maverick. So it's a lot of, like, there's a very different aesthetic and quality, I think, between those movies and this.
Yeah.
But if I had like 400 movies on my list the way that you do, I'm pretty sure this would be in the 200s.
Right. Yeah. We have talked about this before, that you're more of a parts and pieces kind of guy, is the way I believe you put it.
Yeah.
And that, like, again, I can't deny that images look nice in this movie just on their own, separated from everything happening. But like, I really need, like, I crave movies to be cohesive in that way. And I just like cohesive in the way that I think the aesthetic is informing the visuals are informing the ideas being presented by the movie. And that makes up the aesthetic. And I just can't back a movie where I feel the aesthetic is incomplete, that the visuals aren't lending anything. They can't just look pretty. Like, to me, that's not enough. Like, I need it to be like giving me something. So I totally get how you feel, and I do appreciate that aspect about this movie, even though I just spent an hour complaining about it. But it's just not enough for me.
Yeah, I think this is a tough love episode more than it is like, we both hated this movie episode.
God, in a way, I root for a movie like this, because, like, I really do like how Villeneuve started his career. Like, I really want to rewatch Sicario, because I think I might like it this time.
Yeah.
And I think Polytechnic is awesome. Like, I think he has it. I don't know. He's just gone on a path that everybody has loved and I haven't loved. I don't know. I crave for the old days, I guess. Because no one saw Polytechnic back when it came out, I feel like, you know. It wasn't like it had, like, a cult audience.
I still haven't seen it.
Oh, gosh.
I haven't seen that or Incendies.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No. Anyway.
What's next for us?
Oh, wow. We didn't even talk about what's next.
I did just order Sicario on 4K.
Yeah? Yeah, I bet that'll
be awesome. Oh, no. I ordered the Blu-ray.
Did you really?
No!
I was going to say, I didn't even know if it was on 4K.
Yeah, that's dumb. Oh, I feel dumb.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could probably return it. Yeah, or just watch it on Blu-ray.
It was an eBay purchase.
Oh, then you're fucked. All right, in the last month, let's look at our top articles. What's one we haven't covered here? Wow, we've covered all of them. We have Her, The Departed, Shutter Island.
Oh, I keep forgetting we did
and
it.
And Fight Club. I can't believe we haven't done Fight Club.
Should we just do Fight Club?
I mean, I'm into that.
Okay. All right. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, let's do it.
Beautiful.
All right. And so we're going to wrap up. Anything else? Anybody have anything else to say? You, Chris?
No.
A lighting crew? Gaffers? Anybody? No? Okay. So we're going to end the show. We're going to end it by saying lights.
Camera.
See ya.
See ya.
Oh, wow. You took such a long beat. I didn't know where to go.